Good evening again. I don't know if you are aware, but these posts are all about things that are not shit. Things about the world that are nice, positive, make you smile, or just something to listen to at night that's not really challenging, that can help you relax and feel better. And I've listened to a lot of bedtime stories, and it's my turn to be the one to read to you. We're still on the letter C, and the next part of the book on page 37 is cracking a boiled egg. I suppose this falls into the same category as frozen puddles. Taking a spoon and giving a boiled egg a good beating is an immensely satisfying feeling. Not so severing the top with a knife. This is simply wrong and something somewhat alarming. People who adopt that latter method are probably to be avoided. A great practical joke when you are a child is to finish eating the boiled egg, and then turn it upside down, trying to convince some unsuspecting victim, usually your dad, that is indeed a nice, fresh, new one. Actually, you don't have to be a kid at all to enjoy this. I am going to give it a go next time, and I am willing to bet that you do too. Actually, I do like a nice boiled egg and soldiers myself. Right. Cream teas. Every nation is rightly proud of its national dish, but for some reason the English can never seem to decide what it is. Fish and chips was long held to be the meal in question, but then someone would pipe up and argue that the toss for steak and kidney pie. In more recent years, it has been claimed that curry is now the national dish, but this is clearly nonsense. I mean, curry is lovely and a very welcome addition to the national menu, but we should really make an effort to have one stand-out meal that isn't imported. I would like to put forward the case for cream tea. A nice scone, fruit or plain, with a pot of jam and lashings of clotted cream. It's quintessentially English, in the same way as a haggis or deep-fried marsepower to a Scottish. And I don't know, leeks, I suppose, are Welsh. Historians in Tavistock, West Devon, believe they have discovered the origins of the cream tea. Apparently, the Vikings had plundered the Benedictine Abbey there in AD 997. The monks relied on local workers to help them rebuild it. To thank the men, the monks fed them with bread, clotted cream, and strawberry jam. The meal proved to be so popular that they continued to serve it to passing travellers, and the cream tea was born. Now you know. crumpets. I am writing these entries in strict alphabetical order, which means that I am now rather hungry. I could just go a bit. Let me read that again. I could just go a bit of crumpet. Well, that's how it's written. The crumpet has the double honour of being deliciously toasted and also the cause of much innuendo in carry-on films. There are times when only hot crumpet dripping with melted butter will do, and it is an honour in these tunes. Times. Oh dear, I think the eyesight's going now as well. Oh, as well as everything else, right? Okay. It is an honour of these times that crumpets find themselves in this celebration of all things wonderful. Now it's the letter D. I wonder what we'll find in D. I haven't read ahead, you know. I'm reading this cold. That's my excuse for making so many mistakes. Danish pastries. Oh, no. Ah, the breakfast of champions. Whenever I start the day with a Danish pastry, I raise my mug of tea to toast the good people of Denmark. Although apparently I should really be toasting Austrians and Americans as well, in all likelihood. What we know today as a Danish was created in Vienna and made its way to Denmark and other countries in Northern Europe, but some sort of pastry osmosis. Oh, by some sort of pastry osmosis. I think instead of a cellular membrane, it must have been here. Yeah, well, anyway. Its real rise to fame was when it hit the shores of the US, which it did with a great fanfare and huge success. A Danish baker and self-proclaimed patisserie savant by the name of I.C. Klitting. That's spelled K-L-I-T-T-E-N-G. Came to New York towards the end of the 19th century at the invitation of Broadway restaurateur Hermann Gertner. Between them, they managed to convert the nation of workers to the Danish. To do so, they had to battle against the well-established French pastries, which were popular with the moneyed classes at the time. What ensued was nothing short of a propaganda war, albeit a reasonably friendly, and not to say tasty one. In newspaper ads and features across several years, the two men extolled the virtues of Danish pastries with cookery demonstrations and tasting sessions, particularly in and around New York. My favourite quote from one of these is as follows. There is a difference between the Danish pastry and the French. The French pastry is eaten daintily and slowly, allowing each new discovery to sink in, and the flavours to blend one by one until the effect of the whole is as an, oh, what's that say? Arabian, oh, dream of gastronomic thoughts. I wasn't expecting that to be Arabian. Right. But this is all in italics, that's why it's more difficult to decipher. Right. But with the Danish pastry, You just tuck a small morsel under the tongue, roll up the eyes and say, ah, as to... might have done that a bit too much. We're overacting here. Anyway, as though they were a skyrocket present, and it fades away and trickles down to the barbed wire entanglements of the soul. A subtle something that clings like an opium eater's dream. You see, Nigella Lawson, eat your heart out. The next one. Ulysses de la Cruz. Footballers are, on the whole, an overpaid, arrogant bunch, who think that the occasional appearance on Children in Need, or Comic Relief, makes them appear humble and worthy. I don't begrudge their salaries. Get what you can, lads. I know some do make a bit of an effort, but Ecuadorian footballer Ulysses de la Cruz puts most of them to shame. De la Cruz comes from the remote village of Piquiichu. Well, that's what I'm sticking with. Three hours north of Ecuador's capital, Quito. Oh, for goodness sake. The people of Piquiicho tended to live in ramshackle houses in the area. Oh, and the area was largely neglected by the government. But in recent years, it has seen major rejuvenation. Eleven miles of fresh water pipes have been laid to rid the village of the fungal infections spread by years of dirty water. A medical centre has opened with a full-time doctor, dentist and nurse. Education has been given a boost with a new roof for the local school, along with hundreds of books and a playground. Every morning, 100 primary school children get breakfast and lunch provided for free. Meals they may not have received otherwise. A new complex of homes built to modern standards is now underway. Every single penny for this reconstruction and improvement has come from the pocket of Ulysses de la Cruz, currently playing for Reading in the Premiership. This is 2007, remember, when the book was written. The footballer sends back 10% of his salary to fund the work of the foundation that he set up. His mother, Edita, is in charge of making sure the money goes to the right causes. Unlike many footballers who count their success in trophies, adulation and sponsorship, De La Cruz equates his triumphs with what they can do for his home village. In the 2006 World Cup in Germany, when we reached the second round, it was important because the success means I can finance a new sports and community centre now under construction. That's nice. Nice thing, isn't it? Digital radio. It seems somewhat petty to hail the virtues of non-crackly radio just after the humbling tale of a selfless South American footballer. But alphabetical order tends to throw up these anomalies. Of course, it isn't just the better reception that makes DAB digital radio cool. So cool. Finally, we radio enthusiasts have the same sort of technology as television addicts have had for ages. We can now pause shows when the phone rings or we need the loo. We can access an EPG, electronic program guide, to see what is coming up and scroll text. And the scrolling text will tell us which song we are listening to or who is being interviewed. And if you are impressed by this, then just wait till you reach the exciting radio entry under I. Discovering water. There is a sudden rush of pleasure when you accidentally come across a stretch of water. You're out walking through the countryside and find a pond or stream that you weren't expecting. Or better still, a lake or a river. Although, if it is the latter, then you really need to hone up on your map reading skills. I was once walking the grounds of a stately home and found a waterfall, a good 30 feet tall, that I had no idea was going to be there. And it was magical. Standing next to water always makes you feel better, doesn't it? Drawing pictures in steamed up windows. In years to come, archaeologists will unearth fragments of glass, breathe upon them in excitement and discover a whole new language, a world of mysterious hieroglyphs containing smiley faces and stick men. Duck-billed platypus. Back to the creationist argument, many religious folk hold up the duck-billed platypus as proof that God exists. Only a supreme creator could come up with something so unique, they say. Atheists and those of a lot less fervent holy persuasion just look at the animal and laugh. If there is God, then he quite possibly was off his face when he made that one. That's probably blasphemous or something, I don't know. When the first platypus specimens were brought to England, they were viewed as a hoax. Here was an animal with a tail like a beaver, but a duck bill for a nose. It laid eggs in the same way as a reptile or bird, but suckled its young like a mammal. It went against all the perceived notions of science at the time, so it had to be a joke. Although our knowledge has increased sufficiently since to recognise that the platypus is an actual real animal, there are still huge gaps in our understanding of this odd-looking creature. Its mating habits are largely a mystery, and we have no idea how the long gestation period lasts. The frontal shield at the top of the bill, that's the bit that rises up onto the forehead, is assumed to serve some purpose, but zoologists have yet to work out what they may be. I hope the platypus keeps its secrets for a while yet. Fascinating fact. The duck-billed platypus uses its tail in much the same way a camel does for its hump. It's made up of fatty tissue, which it uses as food in the lean winter months. I think the proper term would be uses to sustain itself. Otherwise it infers it might be eating its own tail. But we know what it means. Oh, this is a good one. Dunking biscuits. Forget the cure for cancer or life in outer space. What scientists really need to be spending their time doing is working out the best method for dunking biscuits. And thank God they have. Or should we? Whilst I rejoice in the idea that some boffin somewhere has wasted thousands of pounds of research grants calculating the precise formula for dunking perfection, the world needs such whimsy. It turns out that their findings are completely useless. get this. Dr. Len Fisher from the University of Bristol ran not one but two separate experiments into the physics of biscuit dunking. The first one was on method and the second on flavour, and here's what he found. The ideal way to dunk a biscuit is to do so horizontally. By this, he means literally lowering the biscuit flat into the liquid so that only the underneath is dunked. You remove it and quickly flip it upside down so that the undunked half supports the wet portion. As for flavour, the best drink to dunk it in is milk, hot or cold, and not tea or coffee. A good milk drink increases the flavour by a factor of 10, apparently. He also worked out that dunking in lemonade reduces the flavour. Yeah, no shit, Sherlock. Both of these results are, as you are no doubt aware, utter tosh. Dunking biscuits is always to be done by dipping the biscuit in vertically, immersing half of the solid into the hot liquid, and then rushing the whole thing to your mouth before it drops off. And the only drink worthy of dunking it in is a nice cup of tea. You don't need a fancy degree and a white coat to know that one. Well, that's probably enough for now. That's 20 minutes. That will leave the letter E for next time.